Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Adam Goodhart, who's an historian, essayist, and journalist, who is director of Washington College's C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience. He's a regular columnist for the New York Times' acclaimed Civil War series, Disunion, and is the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Goodhart.
Good to be here.
And clearly we are talking because the Chief of Staff of the White House, General John Kelly, was on Fox News on Monday evening for the inauguration of Laura Ingraham's new show, and he offered his opinion on the Civil War in the context of Confederate monuments, and expressed the idea that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man and that the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War. That's created quite a stir amongst historians. So you're a Civil War historian. Are you upset?
I don't know if upset is exactly the right word. More sort of amused. You know, it's funny because as historians, we're always saying that we would like our political leaders to think about history and take history into consideration with the decisions that they make and talk about history in our public life. And then as soon as they actually do, it's often something that's so wince-producing, as in this case, that you sort of wish they had just shut up and kept their mouths shut in the first place. So this is definitely one that's, I would say, wince-producing at best, and it's wrong on so many different levels.
Well, to give the full quote, this is what Kelly said last night on Laura Ingraham's new show on Fox News. "I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days. Now it's different today. But the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War, and men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand where their conscience had them make their stand." Now, I must say, good people on both sides has an awful, uncomfortable echo of Donald Trump's recent remarks about the Nazis in Charlottesville.
It certainly is. And I think clearly with the monuments, we have to separate the individual people from the cause that they were fighting for, and I think that we can talk about the individual leaders as well of that movement without necessarily indicting every single person who was involved in any way. I mean, people have many different reasons for going to war. We see that in every war, and was every last human being who was involved with the Confederate States of America an evil human being? Well, as a historian, I believe in degrees of subtlety, and I'm not ready to make that dismissal. But I do think that there's no question that the Confederate cause was an evil cause, and everybody who fought in the service of it was fighting for a cause that was wrong and evil and literally murderous. And I would call it a terrorist. When you think about Robert E. Lee, he killed more Americans, more members of the U.S. Army and Navy than Osama bin Laden or the Taliban could ever have dreamed of. 750,000 people died in the Civil War, about half of them Union. So think of that on the scale of 9/11. Several hundred 9/11s, and you get a sense of just what scale that treachery caused death on.
But have you ever been able to figure out the mindset that comes along with this revisionist history of, you know, that came out during Jim Crow, and the idea, and it's sort of been, and that's when all these Civil War monuments were erected, and this whole sort of nostalgic idea of the noble lost cause. I never could understand, though, and it perpetuates largely amongst sort of the heirs, if you will, of the very people who fought for the Confederacy, and they were poor white farmers, blacksmiths, cobblers, you name it, fighting ultimately for the plantation owner's right to replace them with slaves.
Well, I think that there are a few different questions here, and to address the first one first about when this was initiated and how it was perpetuated, I feel pretty strongly that although most of those monuments are located in the South, some of them are located in the North, we can't talk about this as a Southern problem, and we can't say that this is something that Southerners, white Southerners, have to solve. This is something in which white Northerners were also deeply complicit. This is a problem of the United States of America, that after the war, there was this question of, as there is in many civil wars and many civil conflicts, whether you look at Nicaragua or South Africa or Iraq, when the fighting starts to die down, there's this question of, okay, well, do we want to hold the grudges or do we want to try to let them go? And in the United States, as in many post-Civil War nations, there was a decision made by a lot of people, or a lot of people favored sort of letting it go and embracing forgiveness and welcoming the prodigal brothers and sisters of the Confederacy, as they saw it, back into the American fold. And this was really Northerners, white Northerners, as much as it was white Southerners. But there was also something that was darker at work there, and that has to do with the role of African Americans in this new post-Civil War America. Lincoln, of course, during the war, had promised a new birth of freedom. That's what a lot of people thought that the United States was getting, including millions of African Americans had high hopes for that new birth. And instead, over the 15 years or so after the end of the Civil War, well, it was something that really continued and perhaps even still continues, but there was a decision made to sort of abandon largely the struggle for black civil rights in favor of a kind of reunion among white Northerners and Southerners. And that really is what sparked this whole idea that, well, even if we're Northerners, white Northerners who supported the Union cause, we can still admire Robert E. Lee and embrace him even as an American hero. I think that's what was motivating that movement.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Goodhart, a historian, essayist, and journalist, who is the director of the Washington College's C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience. And he's a regular columnist for the New York Times acclaimed Civil War series Disunion, and the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. Well, of course, the decision, the remarks by General Kelly, Trump's chief of staff, came up in the context of a question from Laura Ingraham about a decision of a church in Alexandria, Virginia, to remove a plaque honoring Robert E. Lee. So that was the context. But just give me your take on my puzzlement, because you have the South today, politically rather feudal still, right to work, etc. And my sense is that it's still that sort of mentality that seemed to explain, or not explain, but at least raise the question of why were these poor white Southern farmers, etc., fighting for the plantation owner's right to replace them with slaves?
Well, slavery is, of course, a different thing from white supremacy. And while only a minority of Southern whites before the Civil War were actually slaveholders themselves, the system of white supremacy is one that all whites in the South really were invested in. This idea that there was a class of people sort of on the very bottom of society socioeconomically who prevented the poor whites from being in that class. And some people even argue that that's sort of what made American democracy possible. That's what made it possible for slaveholders like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson to say that America could be a republic with broad suffrage, of course not universal suffrage even among whites in those early days, but that there could be broad suffrage because you were writing out that bottom rung. You were excluding what in Europe would have been the peasant class, and these were African Americans. America was really founded on white supremacy in so many ways, and it was white supremacy that continued to build the economy of the South, and in many ways the economy of the North, before, during, and after the Civil War. It was African Americans who provided the labor that literally built these colonies and then states. So of course that's a reason that white Southerners were deeply invested in white supremacy and deeply invested in the Confederate cause.
So white workers weren't in competition with black slaves for jobs?
No, no, far from it. Well, you know, what we think of as jobs wasn't really a concept in the 1840s or 50s or 60s. These were farmers. These were artisans, and you know, I don't think we're talking about a labor market in the sense that we would think about a labor market today.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's easy to point out ways that their interests didn't coincide with those of the planter class, and the planter class really did want to set up a system that was more oligarchical in many ways, even than the pre-Civil War South had been, and consolidate the power of these quote-unquote aristocratic elites. But they played the white supremacy card very skillfully, as I would argue. Many politicians on the right, including Donald Trump and those around him, continue to do today.
Well, I think that is at the heart of the struggle in America today is whether the democracy will survive the plutocracy or how much we have become a plutocracy. But just in closing, though, let me get to what's always been a real disconnect, and that is the Constitution itself, Jefferson and all, with the lofty language, all men are created equal, and they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That obviously did not apply to the slaves, and they represented billions and billions of value to the Southern planters. They tried to finesse it by saying that blacks were three-fifths of a person. George Mason refused to sign the Declaration of Independence for that reason, I believe. He thought that they were trying to finesse something that couldn't be finessed, and eventually would come back to bite you. And it did with the Civil War. Is that a accurate thumb sketch of
I think in most ways that's quite accurate. They kicked the can down the road for a couple of generations and found ways not to deal with the fundamental problem of slavery, the fundamental contradictions of American democracy when you proclaimed universal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, while at the same time denying it to millions of people who were living alongside you. And I think that paradox was really recognized. Lots of people tried to justify it in various ways, but it was impossible to ignore. And so when John Kelly says that the Civil War happened because of a failure to compromise, really it happened because compromises were made for the better part of a century. And then and finally those compromises themselves led to a completely untenable situation.
Well, Adam Goodhart, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Adam Goodhart, who's an historian, essayist, and journalist, who is director of Washington College's C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience. He's a regular columnist for the New York Times acclaimed Civil War series, Disunion, and is the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was